podcast this week. I may have just returned from a ship, but it's already time to board another ship, the Rose of Nevada, as we talk to that film stars Callum Turner and George Mackay. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that reckons the greatest miracle of them all. It's not dew glistening on a newly formed leaf. It's not the sweet laughter of a newborn baby. No, it's Wi-Fi on a cruise ship in the middle of the ocean that allows this podcast to be edited. What a time to be alive. Hello, Pod. I am Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. I'm back. Apologies after 2 weeks away, most of which was spent on the high seas battling pirates to get to the buffet on the good ship Discovery. But anyway, I'm back. I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. The mad Titan himself is here. Please welcome James Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I'm basically living out my own personal version of The Happening at the moment.
You nearly died there.
I did. So you won't have heard this on the podcast.
Unless I keep it in, but I don't think it will.
Because there are trees that are out to get me. And they're coming for me. And frankly, it's just a matter of time.
I'm going to dig into that in a second. But I've got to introduce our next colleague of such lethal cunning. She stood in for me in the host's chair for the last 2 weeks. But I am sorry to say that Helen O'Hara has been replaced on the show once it became apparent that the role we created for her did not align once in the pod booth. However, I am delighted to welcome her replacement. Please welcome our new geek queen, Laura Dern. How are you?
Hello. Yeah.
You sound just like Helen, Laura Dern. This is amazing.
I commit.
You have studied every facet of Helen. Every aspect of Helen.
I've actually had my legs shortened by several inches and dyed my trademark blonde hair brown.
Wait a second. You're not Laura Dern. You're Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Welcome. How was it sitting in? Did you sit in this seat or did you sit in another seat?
I went wild with
Tell me
power.
Everything.
We went to a different studio and we recorded and then we stopped recording.
Yes. This is fucking great. This is so good. Incredible.
She's not wrong. That's literally what happened.
Wow.
Like, no, but I was genuinely, like, you left exhaustively detailed instructions.
I did.
Especially for the first week. And they actually were not shit. So that was lovely. They actually worked. I was able to record. By the time the engineer you had arranged to check on me came in, everything was actually working.
So, this is incredible. Can we give me a round of applause?
Yeah, honestly, I was very impressed.
Good. Very well done. Well done, Chris. Well done.
Because I don't know what I'm doing, so I don't know how I managed to communicate that to Hell's Bells. Did you like my little thinly failed reference to the Helena Bonham Carter situation
on
the White Lotus? James, this is a TV thing.
It was,
you'll excuse us for a second.
Oh, it's fine. Yeah. We've already talked about it on the policy.
Oh, have you?
No,
I have you.
Yeah,
but this will be a good conversation about it. So,
of course.
So this was the shock news this week that Helena Bonham Carter had started filming on season 4 of The White Lotus. I believe she was playing The White Lotus. And then all things didn't align.
No.
She's left the production.
She has.
They made a mysterious statement saying things did not align once on set. And now she's been replaced by Laura Dern. Is the White Lotus one of the trees that can kill you?
Do you know what?
What's happening?
Lotuses may come for you.
I know
for
the White Lotus isn't a tree.
I mean, it could grow in a tree.
It could.
You don't know.
Could it?
Yeah.
Maybe.
No.
Well, look, so I don't know. Helen, you have the look of a nerd or a botanist.
Laura Dern.
Perhaps you can tell us, Laura Dern, are you in fact replacing Helena Bonham Carter? Because, you know, surely you'd know.
I couldn't possibly say because I'd be probably under an NDA.
Oh, that makes sense. Mm. Anyway, you know the trees that litter the West End of London? Those awful, horrible, evil, killer trees. Do you know what type of tree they are?
Mostly plane trees, I believe. Yes.
They look quite decorative to me.
Plane, I think it's actually spelled the other way, but not like a whoo through the airplane kind of way.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Why do they molt what I can only describe as kind of brown fluff, like brown hairs? Like they molt these things, and it's disgusting at the best of times, but it's very windy
today. It goes down your mouth.
And it goes down your mouth. It goes in your nose, in your eyes. You breathe it in. It's on your skin. I am covered in it now. These trees are out to get me. They're trying to kill me.
Have you
Much
thought
like
about
you yourself, Helen?
Have you thought about using these things to fashion a nice hair?
Do you know what? If I stayed out long enough, I would have a fetching kind of brown fuzz on my head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that could work for me.
I mean, drama much? Jeez, it's just a tree.
Have you seen The Happening? Have you seen The Happening?
Yeah.
Have you seen Poltergeist?
Have you seen how bad The Happening was?
Have you seen William Friedkin's The Guardian? Trees are out to kill us, Ellen/Laura.
Wow.
Trees are out to get us. You should know better than anyone else from your experiences on Chex Notes, Jurassic Park. The trees are out to get us.
I think from my experience on Jurassic Park, I know that ferns are our friends, you know, but that they shouldn't use prehistoric poisonous plants around dinosaurs.
That's a great big pile of shit. All right.
It certainly was.
So, shall we move on to... Oh, no, I've opened the Premier League app. That's not good, especially not this season. Shall we have a question?
Let's.
Yes, let's do it. Let's do it. I've asked Instagram for questions because it was such a roaring success last time I did it. And Helen, you did it as well, didn't you? So I did edit those podcasts. I genuinely edited... I edited last week's podcast in a combination of Manchester and Hebden Bridge in Yorkshire. But the week before, genuinely, I edited it on a cruise ship in the middle of the ocean using the shittest Wi-Fi I have ever seen. But it's a miracle because Wi-Fi shouldn't exist in the middle of the ocean. What a time to be alive, genuinely. It was amazing.
Of course, you've been on a cruise ship before, though, haven't you?
Is this going to be a joke?
Yeah.
Okay, what is it?
Because you were on the set of Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, and it was a ship. And
no, James, that was a submarine.
It was a cruise ship.
Because you
fucking idiot.
Tom Cruise.
It was a submarine, a Russian submarine, the Sevastopol.
Yeah.
As seen at the beginning of Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, not part one.
It's a ship.
Oh, my God.
It's a cruise ship.
Idiot. Cruise ship. That's good. All right. So I've asked people for questions. They have responded in their tens. No, it's been a roaring success once again this time. A lot of people have asked the best scenes on a cruise ship or a boat. Best scenes on a cruise ship or a boat.
Step Brothers.
The boats and
I didn't know you were going to go there. I mean, Jaws was right there, but carry on.
Oh, no. I take it all back.
Brody and Quint, they got to have their boats and hose.
The African Queen. Good boat.
Yes, yes. Or it's much better remake, Jungle Cruise, starring Emily Blunt.
Ew.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson, yes. And of course, Jack the Hall Whitehall.
Mm.
Yeah.
Jack the Pebble Whitehall.
Let's move on.
No. So what's so great about the... Okay, so someone said best scenes, best boat cruise-based scenes. That's rather than saying movies.
Oh, scenes.
Yeah.
That's narrow in.
Scenes are a good shout.
Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish lady.
Would that be the best scene in the film?
Best,
I don't know that
it's the Indianapolis speech.
Yeah, that's in the same speech. Oh, no, it's not. You're right. Okay, fine.
Helen.
He does start singing at the end of that scene, though, doesn't he?
You brought a knife to a shark fight.
Yeah. There is a scene, and unhelpfully, I can't remember where in the film it is, but I think it's quite early on, in Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, where the attacking gunship comes out of the mist.
Yes.
And all of the cannibals come in, and the sound design in that sequence is fucking unbelievable. It's cannibals whizzing left and right over your head. It's really, really good. Splintering masts and whatnot. But yeah, it's a really good scene.
That is a really good scene.
Would you say, James, that's the lesser of two weevils?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay. Oh, wow. You've forgotten the scene from Master and Commander then.
That's the best one on a boat.
For exploding ship scenes, I also really like, is it Pirates of the Caribbean 3? When Tom Hollander, down the
stairs. There's a good scene in Pirates of the Caribbean 3.
Yeah, there is one.
Oh, come on.
Where Tom Hollander's walking down the stairs as the ship basically explodes around him. It's a very cool moment.
It's very memed. Yes. I know the one.
Yeah. That's a very, very cool moment.
But can you count a scene that's, you know, on a soundstage and not on a boat?
I don't know that it was on a soundstage.
Yes, because a lot of early, like Lifeboat, if we can't count soundstages, we can't count Lifeboat.
This is true.
Because as we all know, Titanic was shot entirely on the actual Titanic at sea.
Yeah.
So, you know, famously.
Yeah. I don't know. I think Gore Verbinski would have shot a lot of that on actual, like,
volume,
floaty bits.
You reckon?
Yeah. I don't think it's volume.
Floaty bits.
Floaty bits.
I think it was in front of a great big blue screen.
I don't think it was. I don't think it was. And I dare you to prove it. It looks good. I think it was actually shot outside because the lighting
on the Disney lot.
No, not yes. on the Disney lot. I think it was shot on floaty bit or a tank. Your beloved James Cameron shoots this. He cheats all the time on a fucking floaty bit.
How dare you? The man's been living on Pandora for the last 20 years.
And he did have a giant tank on Titanic, yeah, famously.
He did. Yeah. He
what
did.
About the
abyss?
Were they on a boat in the abyss at any point? Not really.
It's an undersea complex.
Under the sea.
But yes, there is a boat in it.
Barely a boat in that one, yeah. I don't think.
That was shot in a nuclear missile silo, as I recall.
Is there anything in the MCU, any hot boat action in the MCU?
Are people
like to ship the MCU, but is there a ship in the MCU?
I see what you did there.
Thank you.
Sam has a boat in
Sam
Falcon
Wilson.
And Winter Soldier.
He does. Yeah.
Yes, who can forget?
I wouldn't say it's a thrilling scene, but it exists.
Oh.
Spaceships?
The beginning of Winter Soldier, it takes place entirely on the Lemurian star, which I believe is a star, Lemurian star, because there's the Northern Star in Daredevil Born Again at the moment, but I think it's the Lemurian star.
You're right, yeah.
In Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and that's a pretty kick-ass action scene.
I put it to you, no other person alive knows the name of that boat.
That's not true.
You two might take are me a such second, nerds.
No, we're not such
we're
nerds.
Not such, we just watched The Winter Soldier, which is like one of the best MCU films.
Who throws a shoe? I mean, who knows the name of the boat, honestly?
Jasper Sitwell knows the name of the boat.
That's
you
right.
know what? That doesn't sit well with me.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Deep Rising.
Yes!
No!
Fucking yes!
Can I just say...
What a film!
When discussing the fact that you were not on the podcast when we did the shameless plug, I mentioned that if people wanted to know what your cruise was like, they should look up the Treat Williams film, Deep Rising, and I'm sure it went much like that.
What a treat. Mm. What a treat. Oh, deep... What's it called? Deep Rising?
Yes.
The film's so good.
Best film of 1998.
Poseidon Adventure.
Oh, Helen sidetracked me. She knows I was about to go on a long, long diatribe, but a good one. About Deep Rising.
Which doesn't deserve it.
It absolutely
Deep Rising is a masterpiece.
Deep Rising is very mid.
Laura Dern.
I watched it again just a year or so ago.
You
guys go on about it so much.
Just a few months ago. What was the night that all the scary stuff happened? Halloween? There was it was on one of the TV stations on my television, and I watched it. Until my wife made me turn it off because she can't stand horror films. And I was like, it's not that bad. Young Jason Fleming's about to get horribly killed. But that didn't persuade
that
her.
Incredibly. Wow.
But there's so many great up-and-coming actors in that. Chaiman Honsu's in that. Jason Fleming's in that. Famke Janssen's in that. You know,
sure.
She's got great chemistry with Treat Williams. May he rest in peace. Mm. Kevin J. O'Connor is so funny in that as well. Stephen Sommers' best film by a country mile. Prove me wrong,
the
Silent
Mummy
Bob.
The Mummy absolutely disagrees. And actually, there's a good boat scene in The Mummy on the Nile when they're attacked on the boat. Ends with, hey, Benji, I think you're on the wrong side of the river.
Oh,
Great scene.
Yeah, okay.
The Mummy's okay, but it's not as good as Waterworld.
How does that even come into it?
It has a boat,
it's not
it? Many,
Stephen
many,
Summers
many
film.
Wonderful boats. No, it doesn't.
Also,
it's a
much worse film. Like, no one's clamoring for Waterworld 4 right now, are they? No.
I put it to you right now that I have, and I can say this with a completely straight face, seen Waterworld many times more than I have seen The Mummy.
I would say exactly the reverse, and I think that says a lot about both of us.
And it's 3 hours long.
It is not a good film. It's better than its reputation at the time.
Yeah.
But that's not a good reputation. So it is not a good film.
I don't know. Look, he saves the little plant. It's very
heartfelt. What's the Gilman? What's he called?
The Mariner.
The Mariner.
Mm.
Yes.
Come on.
No. I refuse.
I bet he's a sub.
Oh,
come on. Oh. There's got to be something like Submariner, right? Namor. Black Panther, Wakanda Forever.
Aquaman.
There's got to be a scene on a boat.
Yeah.
Equally, Aquaman. Both of those films... I'm putting into
Put Are we counting submarines? Because if we're counting submarines, then my beloved Red October gets
No, again. Helen, we're not, because I'm going to read out the question once again as soon as I find it. Best cruise/boat-based scenes in a movie.
They call submarines boats. They specifically call
that
submarines
is true.
Boats.
A U-boat, in fact.
Mm. Well,
I've been on a nuclear submarine once.
Have you?
Mm. In New York, when you visit the USS Intrepid, there's a nuclear sub parked next door, and you can visit that too.
Well, I've been on the boot. The
Dust
literal
boot.
Boot from Dust Boot. I've been in the boot.
My
the original
God.
Boot.
Wow.
Yeah, because there's a studio in Germany, and they have the boot there, and I got to wander around the boot.
Wow. This is amazing.
It was a very long time ago. I think I was 15? But yeah.
I was once on the HMS Belfast. We sail into history.
I've been on that as well.
So have I.
And the
have
Golden
you?
Hind.
Yeah.
The Golden Hind. Came to Northern Ireland when we were wee.
Were we? Did yeah. we? Did it? Okay. Well, the Golden what now?
The Golden Hind, Sir Francis Drake's ship.
Yeah.
Oh, Sir Francis Drake's ship. Played, of course, by... Clive Owen?
I think.
In Elizabeth?
Golden Age.
Was he in the Golden Age?
Pretty sure it was the Golden Age.
Was he sure not the first one as well?
Pretty sure the Golden
okay,
Age.
Okay, pretty sure the Golden Age. All right. We haven't talked enough about Jaws.
We can't talk enough about Jaws.
Because it's not just a scene. It's scenes.
Mm.
And arguably the greatest jump scare of all time, Ben Gardner's head is in a boat.
It's in a boat. But it's underwater,
in a boat.
Though. So, I mean, once again, if you're objecting to submarines, that boat is
you
kind
don't,
of...
A boat doesn't cease to become a boat once it goes beneath the waves. A boat continues to be a boat.
Surely it becomes a wreck.
I mean, yes, technically, I guess. But
in
it also,
case.
It's not a wreck because it's just recently wrecked. I would say that to be a wreck, you'd have to be, I think, a little bit older than that. John Carpenter's The Fog, for example. The Elizabeth Dane is the vessel on that. Well, it's a ghost ship. Oh my God. The best scene.
Of course.
The best scene. Okay, so there's great scenes on boats in John Carpenter's The Fog. Amazing film. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's great. But the best scene, I'm going to put it to you, even better than the Indianapolis scene.
Oh,
the greatest, one of the greatest speeches in the history of movies, delivered so beautifully by Robert Shaw in Jaws, written, so legend has it, by John Milius. Some people contend that. John Milius says he wrote it.
He did say to you that he wrote it.
Robert, not to me, but to other people. Okay. Robert Shaw also can claim ownership. There are other people whose oars are in the water on this one. Anyway, amazing, amazing speech. That whole scene is phenomenal. Just the way that it goes from, you know, Brody and Hooper and Quint kind of playing around a little bit on the orca. And then Brody asks, what's that scar? They're comparing tattoos. Mm-hmm. They're comparing scars. And then, of course, that triggers the Indianapolis speech where Quint, played by Robert Shaw, of course, reveals that he was on the USS Indianapolis, a real boat that went down in World War II. Many of its surviving members were picked off by sharks. And it's just one of the most brilliantly delivered, brilliantly written speeches in movie history and should have won Robert Shaw the Best Supporting Actor Oscar that year. He mm-hmm. wasn't even fucking nominated.
Outrageous.
What a disgrace. Anyway, amazing scene. It does not compare. It pales into insignificance.
I dread
yes,
to think what you're
Helen,
going to say.
You mentioned the Poseidon Adventure and Gene Hackman's incredible speech at the end where he rails against God before making, spoiler alert for a film that's nearly 60 years old, a heroic sacrifice, which really, really shocked me. Poseidon Adventure, you can get in the sea. Jaws, you can get in the sea because none of you are the opening of Ghost Ship.
Mm. Oh, I just.
In which the entire crew and complement of passengers on a ship, a beautiful cruise ship, are horribly killed in the first couple of minutes of the movie in one of the most bravura, jaw-dropping bits of gore you will ever see, where a taut razor wire goes through every single one of them, cutting them in half.
I will see you that and raise you that episode in the first season of Three Body Problem, which is, yes, a TV show. But if you're talking people being cut up by very thin wires...
On a ship.
That is the bar.
He's not wrong. It's not a bar, it's a wire, but it's real...
Well, we're talking,
it's very thin.
If we're talking about people being cut up by very thin wires, can I throw in the opening of Cube?
Yes, except which, it's not on a ship.
Yeah, but that's not on a ship.
We don't know that.
That's true, we don't know that. It could be on a ship.
Yeah. We kind of do, because you're at the very end, spoiler, you see the outside of the Cube.
Yeah, but the Cube could be on a ship. We don't know.
It would have to be a spaceship and not a warship. Come on,
although,
we're not counting spaceships.
You could count the whole of Escape Plan if it was, you know, good.
We should. Yeah. Actually, I take back everything I said about Ghost Ship.
Isn't that more an oil rig type thing?
Isn't it like a tanker?
I want to say
it's a tanker.
I think Ellen might be right.
I think it's more of an oil rig. And forget bringing oil rigs into it. We've got a whole other mess of things to look at.
Best oil rig movies.
We can't bring oil rigs into this. Oh, no, we can't do that. Oh, ships. The Pacific Rim, where a bloke picks up a ship and hits a kaiju with it.
Oh, that's pretty good.
That's a good bit.
That's up there with the Indianapolis.
And a ghost ship. All right, we've decided the Ghost Ship is the greatest ship-based movie of all time. Of course, the greatest ship-related thing of all time
is the
Columbo episode, Troubled Waters, which was filmed on an actual cruise ship, an actual working cruise ship. You can see people in the background turning to look at both the camera and Peter Falk as Columbo at various points. Robert Vaughn is the murderer on that. It is a cracking episode. Anyway, shall we move on? Helen's eating something.
I'm having a piece of chocolate.
This never happened when Helen was here. No. Since Laura Dern took over the role of Helen, her unprofessionalism has been off the fucking charts. What are you eating?
Piece of chocolate.
Did you bring enough for everybody?
Technically.
Did you offer it to Chris? I would say, did you offer it to me? But you actually did before the show started. So.
What?
I can't really say that.
This is unbelievable. He asked for it.
Yeah.
All right, listen,
I did have to ask.
We're going to sort this out. We're going to have a little bit of infighting right now. We're just going to have some home truths are going to be said. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to take a little break, and then we're going to come back, and everything's going to be sorted. So here we are. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about movie news. Enjoy. Okay, we are back, and we're all friends again, aren't we, Helen?
Yes, mostly because I've been eating chocolate, so I'm fine.
Yeah, and you've given me how much chocolate?
No chocolate.
Excellent. But then again, I brought you guys no gifts back from the ship.
I did notice
that.
No,
you didn't bring us any gifts at all.
Yeah. I ate them.
Explain yourself.
I ate them all.
Wow.
Also, I hate you guys.
I mean, that's...
Wow.
Yeah, so...
Okay.
Still, fresh start, bygones. all right, so should we talk about movie news?
Yes.
And can I just say, I'm going to pull back the curtain here. So we recorded the podcast last Wednesday. You sent it to me when I was in Manchester and then Yorkshire and I was editing it. And then literally, as you sent it to me, some news broke because you were struggling for news in last week's podcast. And some news broke. Big news surrounding Joseph Kosinski's Miami Vice reboot and the trailer for Clayface, which is the next film in James Gunn's DC universe after Supergirl, of
Correct.
Course.
Yes.
And I was like, guys, should we maybe try and jump on to talk about this stuff to, you know, add a little bit of ballast to the movie news section? And we couldn't do it because of scheduling reasons, and also I didn't have time to incorporate that into the edit. I am so fucking glad we didn't, because nothing has happened since. There has been, like, no news. Like, zero news. I mean, some stuff has happened. In the real world, some stuff has happened. But in the world of movie news, very little has happened. So, thankfully, we could talk about the Miami Vice 85 news, because this is confirmation. Joseph Kosinski, director of Top Gun Maverick and F1, his next movie is going to be a remake, a big screen version of Miami Vice. But okay. But this one, in case you can't tell, is going to be set in the 1980s, just as the Michael Mann TV show was in the 1980s, starring, of course, Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas as Crockett and Tubbs. This is going to star Austin Butler and, fresh off the Oscar, Michael B. Jordan.
Ooh.
Yeah. Exciting.
I quite like that they're forefronting the fact that, unlike the Michael Mann film version of this, they are going to embrace the era.
Yes. So
espadrilles, you know, shoulder pads.
Phil Collins.
Yeah, all of that. Jan Hammer. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
The style will be extreme, yeah. And at least, you know, we have the advantage that Austin Butler looks okay as a blonde, which was not the case, in my opinion.
He doesn't have to be blonde.
He doesn't have to be, but they shouldn't have made Colin Farrell blonde then, should they? I hold a grudge.
I know this is your opinion. You have said before on the podcast that Colin Farrell is one of nature's natural
brunettes.
Yeah. And that he doesn't look good blonde. I think he does.
No. He obviously still looks good blonde. He looks ridiculous.
Not good, Helen. Great.
But he looks less good.
Can I say...
He looks unnatural.
I think the problem in Michael Mann's 2006 version of Miami Vice, in case you don't know, Michael Mann was not the creator of Miami Vice, but he was certainly instrumental in establishing the look and tone of that show and giving it its cool, and he directed the pilot and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And... You know, he directed, obviously, in 2006, a big screen version, which is much maligned, but I really, really like, starring Colin Farrell, yeah, Jamie Foxx as Crockett and Tubbs.
So many people like it. I went back and rewatched it last year because I was like, what am I missing? Everyone else loves this movie. Mm. There must be something wrong with me. No, it's bad.
It's not bad.
It is bad. It doesn't have an involving plot.
It's not about a plot, Helen. It's about vibes.
Like the vibes are confused even.
You just can't get past the fact that...
I tried, I really did.
I put it to you, it's not Colin Farrell as a blonde. It's the fact that his haircut is awful and it given him that stupid porn star tash as well. Which doesn't help also. But
even then, it's not a good film. I didn't like it.
Okay. Wow. James, do you have an opinion on either Miami Vice, the TV show, or Miami Vice, the 2006 film?
I very much enjoyed Miami Vice, the TV show, and it had a banging soundtrack. I don't know quite what Austin Butler's going to look like in a white suit, a fluorescent pink T-shirt, and loafers, but, you know, I'm excited to see that.
He's going to look pretty cool.
He's going to look like Austin Butler.
He's going to look like Austin Butler, exactly that. The actual film, so I have not revisited Michael Mann's film since I went to the press screening of it, and the thing that I remember most about that, as I believe I've mentioned many times in this podcast, is that the sound mix was so terrible, I found at least half the dialogue almost incomprehensible. So I don't know whether that is still the case when you listen to it at home, but the screening was a horror show.
I actually turned on subtitles, and usually I think that's a sign of, you know,
weakness.
Yes.
Encroaching age. All of these things.
Look, hey, many good people use subtitles as standard.
I like it. I don't wish to judge.
Takes me out of the film.
I've adopted that process.
No.
You were born in the dark. I merely
adopted the dark. I was born in it.
That's right. I always get that wrong. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It took me years to get the curiosity thing, you know, from Django Unchained.
I do.
Well, so you had my attention, now you have my curiosity. No, it's the other way around. But it's the same thing with that. I can never get that right. You were born in the dark and I'm really adopted. That makes no sense. Anyway. Oh, scenes in a boat. The ferry in Dark Knight.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay,
is that the best scene on a boat?
No, but I'm just saying. We're just saying. So that's a scene on a boat. But yeah, I'm really excited about this. The Michael B. Jordan of it all is also very, very interesting because obviously... He has a shiny gold guy, and this is one of his first moves post-winning the Oscar for Sinners.
He's unlikely to be holding it during the film, though.
I don't know.
It's the kind of film where...
It's a huge flex.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that, if he's just holding it, and they never reference it, but in every scene, it's just in his hand?
He's also a very cool guy. Like, it just feels like it's going to be an insanely stacked film, I think.
Yeah.
But the attitude, you know?
Massively over the top and massively 80s with, you know, I just think it'd be incredible. Bags of cocaine being thrown left and right. It's going to be extraordinary.
So you think they should really lean into just 80s, attitudes as well?
But this is the thing. So I actually quite like the idea of something that's set in the 80s but isn't poking fun at the 80s. That's just reveling in the excess of the 80s without deliberately sending it up in a kind of satirical way.
So multiple scenes in a strip club then.
Yeah, and there'll be that ridiculous sports cars, mad boats, great boat scenes, all of that stuff, but without the tongue-in-cheekness, just a kind of a very sort of, maybe a slight knowing smile.
Okay.
Miami Vice has a good boat scene where Colin Farrell takes Gong Li to Cuba. on a romantic
date.
That's true.
Yeah.
It opens with boats. It opens with a shot that bobs up from... I've only seen this movie twice. I seem to know it intimately, but it bobs up from under the water to reveal muscular racing boats flying across the water. But I'm intrigued by the Michael B. Jordan casting because it's Crockett and Tubbs, right? And they're very much presented as a duo in the TV show and in the film. And in the film, they're given pretty much equal weight, Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. But certainly in terms of the TV show, Don Johnson became the big breakout star of that show. And I haven't gone back and rewatched Miami Vice, the show, but I imagine that Crockett became the main star of that show. And here you'd imagine that, the guy who's just won an Oscar is going to make sure that he is not playing second fiddle to the guy who doesn't have an Oscar. So I think that could be a really, really good thing, that it could actually be a Crockett and Tubbs equal partnership.
Or Tubbs and Crockett, maybe.
Tubbs and Crockett, fuck it, yes.
Do we know for sure that which one is Crockett and which one is Tubbs? I mean,
you're making an assumption.
I'm doing the Laura Dern, Helena Bonham Carter thing here, but I'm pretty sure it's that. Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah, and Joseph Kosinski is a director who very, very stylish. Quite stylish, and I think I'm really excited about this. I think this could be a belter. I'm gonna say it.
Yeah, all right.
I'm putting my reputation on the line here. This could be a belter. Also, something we didn't talk about last week, and I'm glad we didn't, because we can talk about it now, is the teaser trailer for Clayface.
Mm-hmm.
So have at it. What happens in this teaser trailer for Clayface?
Very much kind of a teaser trailer, but we get to see the Clayfaciness of Clayface. So it's a kind of what if he could take his face off, I guess, is essentially the idea here, right? This is the superhero movie as a horror movie.
This is
full on body horror. An actor who he was originally, this is Matt Hagen, who's played by Tom Rhys-Harries, has a horrifying sort of disfiguring accident. And
before you can say Dr. Peyton Westlake.
Essentially, yes. Turns to Naomi Aki, apparently playing a scientist who can transform his body and give him this clay-like substance to cover his face. Sort of Aardman style, not really. And
that'd be amazing if he had this massive overbite.
Whenever he goes out, he turns into Wallace.
Cheese. No, it's more horrifying than that would be.
Wow.
Actually,
that would be pretty horrifying, I think, to be honest.
Yeah, so it looks pretty scary. It genuinely looks quite scary.
So this was a film that wasn't in James Gunn's plans until Mike Flanagan, who obviously knows his way around a horror film, pitched it to him, and James Gunn went, "Oh, that sounds great." And so Mike Flanagan has written the screenplay. Hossein Amini is also credited with the screenplay. Maybe he came on after Mike Flanagan, because Mike Flanagan is a busy dude, too busy directing the new Exorcist movie to direct this. So James Watkins, fresh off Speak No Evil, great British horror director. He is handling this. And the trailer, the teaser looks really, really freaky. So it's basically the guy who is Clayface lying in a hospital bed, bandages around his face, and the camera pushes in on him. And then we cut to various horrors happening. So this looks like a really freaky, potentially gory body horror, probably properly fucked up. Properly fucked up, like me saying properly. And this looks... Yeah, I'm very, very excited about this. And I'm excited by the fact that it wasn't in James Gunn's plans, and now it is. And so, therefore, there's a compelling reason to do so.
Yeah.
I like that it leans into the horror in a way, because we've had lip service to horror. I mean, I guess Multiverse of Madness plays lip service to horror. And New Mutants was, I guess, technically a horror film as well.
It was horrifying for anyone who watched it.
For so many reasons. But I think this one, like, I was properly chilled by the trailer. And I like the idea of a proper horror in this world. And yes, I could, of course, make an oh-so-funny joke about how I thought Superman was also a horror movie. And while I'm not really, as you know, in the tank for Gunn's vision for DC,
I've noticed.
This one interests me.
Yeah, I think I think it is interesting. I think, like we said, just the fact that the script was good enough is exciting because no one's clamoring for Clayface. Otherwise, I don't think,
I hope that's a tagline. No one's clamoring for Clayface.
But, like, this is the way that movies should be made. It's like somebody sees a good story and something that will be striking on screen and therefore makes it. Not just because Q4 is light on tent poles. Do you know what I mean? We need to exploit our IP ASAP. Like, you know,
that guy didn't get a dividend this year.
Exactly. And I'm excited for that. I think that's a really good reason to be making a film. James Gunn is also making Superman 2 at the moment. Man of Tomorrow.
Yes, Man of Tomorrow.
So that's exciting as well. That's not gone into production. There are more and more rumors of casting and things for that, which is which
I liked.
Is cool.
I liked your theory the other week that Adria Arjona is not playing the character that she's been announced as, but as she might be playing Wonder Woman. I don't think it's going to pan out that way. I think he's pretty much, he plays a straight bat.
Yeah.
Does James Gunn for the most part. I don't think he does lots of bells and whistles and...
Just asked the question. This is not...
I don't do
Amon guarantees.
No.
Better believe it. But it just seemed like a possibility at least.
Yeah.
I think that we know that they're talking about Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
You know, Anna Nogueira, who wrote the screenplay for Supergirl, has also, that's one of the other things on her to-do list, along with Teen Titans, I believe. So, it's in their minds. It's on their minds. It's something they're thinking about. They'd be foolish not to.
She's right there.
She
looks like Wonder Woman. I would cast her.
I mean.
But hey.
Hey.
One thing I liked about the Clayface trailer was that it uses the flaming lips, Do You Realize? Which was also used by James Gunn in Guardians 3.
Hey.
I did not realize.
Crossing the streams. Yeah. Exciting.
Do you realize, James, that you have the most beautiful face?
Yes.
And do you realize that everyone you love someday will die?
Yes.
Good. I will put that on my list of films to watch.
Also on the list should be Jackass.
Oh, I haven't seen this trailer.
Oh.
It's just another Jackass trailer, but it's just
five
very
stars.
Sweet. They all love each other, and then they try their best to kill each other or at least destroy one another's reproductive
so
organs.
Good.
Okay, just imagine, if you will, that I am the kind of person who cannot sanction this kind of buffoonery. Mm. Imagine also, if you will, that I've in my life never voluntarily or indeed involuntarily watched
Helen,
a Jackass.
Yeah.
Spike is going ads right now.
What is the appeal of this? Because it seems like puerile shit.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, you've
hit the nail on it's the head. Such a pure form of puerile shit.
Right.
It's so...
Putting the pure in puerile.
Like, I didn't love it back in the day. I didn't watch the TV show regularly. I was, I was horrified for them that they were doing this to each other. But there's something about them still being here 20 years later and still doing it to each other that I find genuinely moving. And like, Jackass Forever is honestly one of the best cinema experiences I've had in the last 10 years.
I don't know what to do with that comment.
Yes, horrible things are happening, mostly to reproductive organs. Okay, yes, that's true. That's locked in.
I don't know how Johnny Knoxville has children.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes, people are being fired from cannons and gored by bulls.
Yeah.
That's not great. But they just love each other and they cheer one another on. And it's a weirdly non-toxic display of masculinity. It is non-toxic male emotions being expressed through the medium of admittedly kind of self-violence, but there's just something beautiful about it. And I'm not condoning it, and you and your friends at home should not act this way to one another, but I do think there is a purity and a beauty to this push to the extremes that they cheer one another on for and laugh with one another about.
And they inflict it on themselves and not others. I love that Helen, by the way, has intellectualized this, where it's funny because they get hit in the balls repeatedly, which is funny. But also the invention by now.
The
movies, there's a larger scale to a lot of the stunts and a lot of the stuff that they're doing, which is absolutely incredible. But sometimes it's the things that are the lowest fi, if that's a word. I was reminded, I saw a clip the other day, I'm not sure from which Jackass it was, but they punch up their class warriors as well. So they don't inflict pain on others, but they do inflict mental anguish on others. So they go to a golf course, and a really, really high class, well-to-do golf course. And as golfers are taking their backswings, they blow off an air horn and make them miss. And it ends with one of the golfers being so irate that he starts hitting golf balls directly at the trees, which Johnny Knoxville and his gang are ensconced. And it is one of the funniest things. Johnny Knoxville's ad-libbed responses to this guy are absolutely phenomenal. And it's just ultimately a very, very funny, very, very sweet series of movies in which people get hit in the balls.
Yeah. I mean, they did a whole sort of stop motion, or not stop motion, but kind of almost animated man in suit sort of mini disaster movie at the beginning of the last movie that was actually somebody's penis attacking a sort of a city. And it's freaking hilarious.
At no point are you selling this to me.
It was Johnny Knoxville and the Jackass gang escaping from a Godzilla attack, from a kaiju attack. But the kaiju was
I can't remember whose penis it was,
but a penis that had been made up to look like Godzilla, and it was attacking them. And hitting them with various fluids, and it
just sounds so infantile. I can't even with this.
Jimbo, genuinely, I think you might love it.
I think I don't think he would, but I would just go, hi, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to Jackass, and then just show James all the Jackass movies as the stunt, and you would just be sitting there stony faced,
completely unmoved
for five and a half hours or however long it takes to watch this. So this is the new one, right?
This is the new one. Last and best.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, I don't know what it's called, but it's coming out. It's great.
It's coming out, and there's more punching. I don't know what to tell you. That's mostly what there is. Like,
how can they top themselves as well, based on what they've
hopefully
done?
Hopefully not.
Previously. Yes. Don't do that. Yeah. But it should be a lot of fun. Exciting stuff. Bran Helgeland is going to write this screenplay. Have you seen this story?
Yes.
For a crossover movie that will pit Sorrow, as in Sorrow from The Mask of Sorrow, against, and then obviously team up with, Django.
Yeah.
From Django Unchained.
This was talked about.
My curiosity. Now they have my attention.
So there was a comic from 2014 where they meet and team up. And it sort of just about works timeline-wise. Sort of just about.
Only you would care about such a thing. But
of course I care about such a thing. How dare you,
but
sir?
No one else does. This is what I'm saying. Right.
But anyway, that's literally sort of what happens in the comics. Like, they meet, they fight, and then they team up and take down bad guys. But if you think about it, it makes sense, because like Zorro's whole thing is taking down, you know, evil Spanish landowners in California. And Django's whole thing is taking down evil slave owners in the South. So they're against the upper classes, whatever way you look at it.
Like the guys from Jackass.
And it makes sense that they would team up to, you know, take down, like, you know, exploitative people.
Helen, judging from James's face, he's has captured neither his curiosity nor his attention.
And just to be clear, they do not repeatedly hit each other in the balls.
That can be arranged.
We can't rule it out.
Sure.
We can get in touch with Bran Helgeland and ask him to include a couple of scenes. They could be attacked by a giant dick monster.
Is there a big overlap between the Django and Zorro audiences, are we saying?
I've seen both films.
So it's you.
It's me. I'm the problem.
Is this something like, you know, is this something that, you know, Tarantino's becoming a bit more relaxed about this stuff? Does he own the rights to this character?
He's apparently signed off, or it has his blessing.
Yeah. As he's still like faffing around trying to decide what movie he's going to make as his last movie.
I'm not sure we say faffing around.
I'm saying faffing around.
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it to his face.
No.
But I'll say it on a podcast. And then if he gets played to him, I will deny it.
Well, that'll work.
Yes.
You'll be like, that's AI. Yes. I would never say that.
I would never say faffing, Quentin Tarantino.
Obviously, you'll be glad to know I've covered this in a Quentin Tarantino dictionary.
Oh my God, of course.
Mostly available I was, now at all good bookshops?
All good bookshops. Yeah. Mostly I was desperate for Zeds. So.
Zed's dead, baby.
Oh, well, that's in there as well.
That's like me when I hit the pillow at night. I'm desperate for Zeds. We started by talking about Michael B. Jordan. We're going to finish by talking about Michael B. Jordan.
What a day.
Because he has apparently been shopping around town an adaptation of the hit video game Battlefield. Which I never played. I played Call of Duty, but I never played Battlefield. Jimbo, you can tell us about this in a few seconds. And he is apparently teaming up in this with Christopher McQuarrie.
Well, I mean,
a horse just ran in here for a second.
Look, I'm in here for the people. I have no idea what the game is, and I probably won't care, but tell me more.
Jimbo.
Yes.
Tell us, Jesus Christ, tell us about Battlefield.
It's much like Call of Duty, but it's larger scale with more players and more vehicles. You drive around in tanks, you can fly planes, helicopters, do all sorts of shit. It's still just blowing people up. Henry Cavill is a big fan. He likes to fly the helicopters.
Okay, and is there movie potential in this?
I mean, the single player, in my personal opinion, and let's be honest, most people's, the single player component of those games is definitely not the strong point. It's the multiplayer that they live and die by. The single player stories are quite disposable. So, in that it is a game about soldiers shooting each other, it's relatively easy to adapt for the screen.
So, in other words, Chris McQuarrie could just have a World War II tale that he wants to tell, and then just...
Well, it wouldn't be a World War II tale.
No, don't be silly, Chris.
Oh, would it not be World War II? I thought it was World War II.
No.
It's not World War II?
It is not. No.
What is it then?
I mean, generally speaking, it's contemporary warfare. Like they've moved around the timeline a little bit, but contemporary warfare is what it's most famous for.
I thought war stopped with World War II.
If only that were true.
Yeah.
So it's more likely to be like a modern warfare type thing.
All right, so Chris McQuarrie has a World War II story that he wants to update for the modern day and just... plonk the battlefield name on it.
Mm.
And
but you could, like, in the same way of Call of Duty, they've done different eras. Like
Taylor Swift?
Yes, much like Taylor Swift. So I think they've done World War II. They've definitely done World War I at one point. But I think they're definitely best known for their contemporary ones.
All right, that's exciting. Well done, everybody.
Okay. Well, I mean, not yet. Presumably it hasn't happened yet. But
listen, if I were a studio and these two guys came in shopping a battlefield movie around, I would snap their hands off.
I think they've done a Vietnam one as well at one point.
Well, what happened in Vietnam?
Everything's fine now. Don't worry about it.
All right, good. Okay, let's move on. Should we have a guest?
Let's.
How about guests?
Ooh.
Yes, because Mark Jenkins' Rose of Nevada came out last week, and it is about what happens in a small Cornish fishing town when a ship that was considered sunk, like the Elizabeth Dane in John Carpenter's The Fog, mysteriously returns after 30 years away. And it stars George Mackay, who has been on the podcast many, many times, and Callum Turner, who's been on the podcast once before, I think. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure. And this is a big deal because Mark Jenkins is obviously this... you know, very lo-fi indie British filmmaker whose movies have been very, very gritty and low budget up until now. And these are name actors that he is working with in this, which is I don't want to say progression because that sounds like I'm denigrating his previous work, but it is an interesting development.
Yeah.
Thank you, Helen.
Yeah.
A development for him. And we sent along last week to the BFI. This was recorded at the BFI. You ask for miracles, Theo. I give you the BFI. We sent along Alex Godfrey to have a chat with George Mackay and Callum Turner. Apparently, this is Callum Turner's only interview about this movie.
Wow.
Yeah, he chose us. We are the vessel through which he speaks. And now you will hear him talking to Alex Godfrey. Enjoy.
So, hi, Callum Turner. George Mackay, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
I just saw you. We're here on a beautiful sunny day in London Town at the BFI. The way I just saw you greet each other have you not seen each other in a while? Because it looked like maybe not.
No.
We can't even remember the last time. I think maybe Venice.
I think Venice. Yeah. Well, yeah. Film's premiere. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just how it is, right? You'd make a film and then you don't really see each other much when you
we fell out massively on the shoot. Oh, and it's been really awkward since
day one.
So
nightmare. It was my guy.
I think I saw some of it on film, right?
Yeah. No, you know, it's just you kind of ships in the night in a way. You hop onto another job and then when one's home the other one's off on a job. It sounds like we're married.
I know. Co-parenting. Separately. No, it's the nature of the beast, I guess. You know, you get to go and join these projects and have a great time, hopefully, and then you go and do another one, hopefully. And George is someone that, you know, I'll get straight into it. George is someone that has risen with me as I've been doing this. George is, we're the same age. So we started around probably the same time. And, you know, I've always wanted to work with George and, you know, he's one of my favorite actors. So getting to do that and with Mark was a real pleasure. We had a fantastic time, all three of us.
George, now you have to say that Callum was one of your favorite actors.
No, absolutely.
That's why I
teed
him up.
No. Honestly, no. But truly, like not even being funny and just, you know, blowing smoke. It's I was so thrilled when I heard that Callum was part of this because of the work that Callum's doing and like the moves that he's making, the choices that he's making. And I've been an admirer of Callum's work for a long time. So, you know, as soon as I knew he was part of this,
there is something I think of growing up with someone and alongside someone. And George and I actually didn't really know each other. We saw each other at the theater one time and had a chat, and that was about it. And there is something about that, because doing it from 21 or 22 or whatever, and just growing and growing and growing and growing and growing, and just having admiration for someone alongside. And sometimes you don't get, there's lots of people that I have admiration for that I haven't worked with yet, you know, alongside us. And hopefully that happens too. But, you know, it's special when it does.
Yeah.
How did you get to know each other? Did you have time together before this film shot at all, or is it straight into it?
No, it was straight into it. We kind of came down to Cornwall with a week before shooting that was like a week of rehearsals and fittings. But really, when we got there, Mark just wanted, it was about time spent. So we kind of did most of our getting to know each other then. I mean, the first thing that we did, Mark was like, I don't want to look at the script. I want to go for a walk and we'll go for a swim. Yeah. So we did that.
The swim was a rehearsal.
The swim was a rehearsal.
Where were you swimming?
St. Agnes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We just went down to the beach, and it was just about time. And we kind of got back and he said, right, this is the production base. The best thing you guys can do is go around and have cups of teas and get to know everyone. And, so yeah, we just, that was us really. And we went to all the locations and just did everything as a wee gang. And that time spent it's like an ephemeral thing, but it's all part of it, and certainly part of Mark's process, because about building that community and having us come be part of it.
I should fill in the gaps just for people listening. Roses of Nevada, which I've seen twice and loved to bits. A fishing boat gets lost at sea and appears back in this small village out of nowhere, little town, about 30 years later. And then you two get involved on a fishing expedition, and then I don't want to spoil it much. I mean, it's out there, but I knew nothing about this film going in, and I think it was all the better for it. So reality starts to shift, I would say, and identities get blurred. Something I loved about that, though, was that it's not done in a fantastical way at all. I mean, I've seen people call it sci-fi. I've seen people talk about time travel, and maybe on paper, but it doesn't feel like a sci-fi film or a fantasy film or a time travel film. And I think because of that, because it's just told through the eyes of your two characters, it's really unnerving and really unsettling. Did it come across like that when you read the script? Because I'm guessing it was there, but so much of it is about what Mark does with this.
Well, that's what I was about to ask you, if you'd read the script. And I think
it'd be
really interesting in a few months if Mark did release the script, because I remember reading it in my kitchen and just it kind of dripped off the page and just seeped into you. And it was like reading a poem almost. And obviously understanding within the context of Mark's films, the films that he'd made before, what was coming and how he wanted to shoot it and what that would look like. You could really feel it, and it was a fascinating process, that reading of the script, because it was just there, it was just all there. And then upon numerous reads, there's so many questions, and we would play this game, we'd be like, all right, let's say to Mark, we've got it now, because we understand what the script is. And he'd go, no, I don't know. I don't know if that's it. And I think that's what he lends that mystery to you as the audience member, being like, I don't know if this is a sci-fi, I don't know if this is a horror, I don't know if this is a, you know, social realism drama, I don't know what this movie is, but I'm there and I'm present with it. And I think that's his, you know, superpower as a director.
Totally.
Yeah, when he says I don't know, I think that means I'm not telling you.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
but good. After you.
No, you go.
No, yeah, just because, like, to follow on from what Cal was saying, the script is, the writing is so sparse, and I think that's reflected in the action of that you see, and what Cal was saying about Mark's kind of reaction anytime we'd posit a theory about the script, is he doesn't like to spoon feed an audience ever. I think he really respects the audience in that sense, and the sort of sparsity of the writing and of elements of the action or the story is there to welcome people's interpretation or projection and understanding. And he knows that, as soon as tempting as it may be, as soon as he kind of gives a theory, people will attach themselves to that or attach, you know, and let go of their own understanding of it, where it's really open to all's interpretation. And I think he's so careful about keeping that openness always.
And the other thing that I loved about the script and then of the film is, I don't know what's the beginning, the middle, and the end. I don't know what part of the journey we're starting at, and if where the film starts is the beginning or if it's the end, or if it's the middle. And that adds to the mystery and the beauty of it, and the poetic feel, and the, you know, I don't want to say confusion, because it's mystery, right? Mystery is a better word than confusion. Mm-hmm. You're selling a movie, but it is. It's the mystery. It's the mystery to this moment, and you feel like the people.
Yeah.
And I think that's the greatest gift a director can give the audience, if he can translate that feeling from the characters through the way that he edits, or she edits, or shoots it. Transmitting that energy and that feeling off the screen to the audience.
Yeah, that's what was so effective, especially because it's mostly told, I think, through the eyes of your character, George, and you're basically spending, you know, the back half of this film going, what the fuck is happening to me? Am I going mad? Yeah. Are you taking the piss?
Yeah.
I don't want to go into the plot details, like I said, but I think that's why I came out of it thinking this is like a weird horror film, because if that were to happen, if something were to happen like that to you in real life, where you felt like, where you're questioning your own identity and you feel like are you being driven mad or not? That would be absolutely horrific. And I think that's what this film does.
Yeah, totally. And I think I'm so wary of giving anything away or, you know, changing the openness that Mark is so careful to hold. But for me as well, there's that exact feeling that you described in case with my character. As you say, there's themes of shift and identity. What I think is so clever is, without ever being overt, those feelings that I'm feeling as one person feel akin to the life that you perhaps are starting to enter in. Therefore, as Callum said, in the same way with the very nature of the idea of time throughout the film, where things begin and end becomes so difficult to grasp hold of. And that, you know, that is such a particular feeling. And I think this film does that beautifully.
I just thought of something that you just made me realize something that maybe he's gone mad. There is another theory that this is we're in his head and he's gone completely mad.
As Mark would say, could be.
That's the beauty of it. We just discovered 2 years later.
2 years. Well, that sort of ambiguity is always powerful.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it easier to relate to, I think. Otherwise, like you say, you'd be spoon-fed. I think the films are powerful when they pose questions rather than giving answers, and that's what this film does. Had you both seen Mark's other films beforehand?
Yeah.
So was that the draw for you? Was because I imagine if I were an actor and had seen those films, I'd be thinking, I want that experience. I haven't, you know, because every director's different, but Mark is so unique and has got such a distinct voice, and also the way he makes the films. Was that, script aside, did you just want a piece of that experience?
Totally.
Wanted a piece of Jenks.
Yeah. I didn't want to say that.
No, totally. I mean, for me, I just want to work with the best directors, be part of the best work. And I say, you know, actually, you know, best is perhaps an incorrect term to use, but unique work and work where the process is bound into the final piece, which is the case with all, but particularly things that will change my process or celebrate various different processes of work, and having that purity be at the core of the reason for the film's making or any piece's making, that's the stuff that really excites me and that I want to be part of. So this is the perfect example of that.
And I agree with that entirely. But also, additionally to that, the way that Mark has built this community, I think for George and I, it was especially special because we got to go down and join a community that was already kind of like a troupe of artists and actors and creatives that had, you know, this is their third film, Mark's third film, but Mary and Ed and all those guys that have been working with them, that was a real honor to dip into their, to completely be strangers and be welcomed into their world was an additional bonus.
Totally.
What about the tech, or which seems like the wrong word, but Mark uses quite...
You should see the tech.
Yeah. Well, so he filmed it on 16mm, right? On a Bolex, right?
Yeah.
Does that change your experience of making a film? And anyway, apart from, you know...
It's a good question. I asked you that question at the beginning, I don't know if you remember. And I said, does it change? Is it going to change the process? Is it going to change your approach? And you said, no.
I don't think so. I mean, because ultimately you're kind of working towards the take.
Yeah.
You know, you're working towards the take. The way that it altered is we got less of them. And sometimes we would stop in the middle of them as the camera got wound back up.
Mark's arm was hurt.
You know. But ultimately, no. And the learning for me on this one was, you know, to keep you aiming at the target. I think some jobs you get, and the satisfaction is that you know, because of the ability of the tech, that it allows you to try every option.
Yeah.
And that part of the creative process with this one is that it will be decided in the edit. Where with this, Mark, if he needs you just sipping the glass of water for the take, you'll run the scene, but it'll only film you sipping the glass of water.
Yeah.
And that specificity and accuracy just makes you aim at the target, I think, in terms of, right, this is what I think the character wants to say in this moment, so that's what I'm going to give.
And I think the isolation of him as a director, you know, there's no DP with him, there's no gaffer, there's no, I mean, there was a gaffer, yeah, actually, yeah. There was, sorry. But there's no sound, and there's a really stripped back crew, and they're all there, but they're in his head, the crew.
You know,
the team is there, and there's a dialogue that's continuous as we're doing the thing. I found that pretty interesting. But the 27 second takes, I guess it's kind of like just running out of a roll of film.
Mm. Yeah.
If you were to run out of a roll of film, if you were shooting on a film camera, it's just, you just go back. That was interesting. We would say if a scene was 45 seconds, we'd do first 27 seconds and then we'd go back a few lines.
Yeah.
And sort of plaster over it and then,
yeah,
run into the last bit of the scene. It was interesting, definitely. It was unique.
Well, another nerdy question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he can't record sound, dialogue with these cameras, right? Mm. So it's all ADR, right? Mm. Meaning you had to, a few months later, go into studio and re-record all your dialogue. Mm. What is that like as actors when you're on set or on location, giving it your all, you know, performing, you know, delivering the lines? I mean, I take it that didn't influence how you did them. You're still giving it as if it was being recorded, but knowing that no one's going to hear what you're doing there at all, and you're going to have to go in. And does that put you in a different frame of mind at all? And is it weird then a few months later then having to do it precisely to the way you did it visually in the first place?
Well, no, because you know when you start the film what
yeah.
it is, what you're getting into, and you understand that this is Mark's process. But I'm a bit of a pure, like, I think of myself as a purist, and like whenever I do ADR, I really don't like going back over, and if there's a line that can be saved, there's someone walking over it, please save that, because it's on the day and it's true and it's in the moment. And so there is something that you're relinquishing with that, for me anyway. And but you're getting something which is Mark, which is Mark's process, which you've bought into and you believe in and you trust ultimately. And I was the last guy to come in and do the ADR. So I don't know what state of what it was like, probably with Mark's voice doing all the character, probably more interesting than my experience, because your experience was with Mark doing all the voices.
It was, I think it was kind of silent from memory for some of it, but there is a version of this, of the film that exists at one point where Mark ADRs the whole thing himself. He'll just do all the characters' dialogue as a temp, so DVD there is some extras. Sound.
Yeah, release the Jenkins cut.
yeah, the total in his head version.
What was the impression of me that he does? I wonder.
I don't think. Yeah, he wasn't doing voices. There's a sort of strange Mark entirety neutrality throughout the whole thing.
Okay.
But yeah,
another thing that's really great about the atmosphere of the film is the place itself. I think you mentioned it's in Cornwall somewhere, right? Where is it?
Mullion Harbour.
Okay, and did you? I can't imagine it was a long shoot. How long was it, by the way?
No, it wasn't. It was like 6 weeks, 7 weeks.
Okay, actually, it was longer than I thought. But did you get a chance to? Did you live there the whole time you were doing it?
Yeah.
So did you get a chance to embed yourself in that world, in that community? Did you sort of live that life for a while?
No, I mean, not entirely like the characters. I mean, Cornwall as a place genuinely really got under my skin in like the best way. As we were just saying at the beginning, we're lucky enough to jump around to these wee islands of people and places with this job.
Yeah.
And I get quite used to sort of saying goodbye to places and feeling very okay about that, enjoying them presently and then going. Oh, Cornwall, I really missed Cornwall. And I haven't missed places like that when I've left.
Well, yeah.
Cornwall's magic.
Yeah.
Cornwall's a really beautiful place.
Yeah, you love it.
I've been down so many times. Mm-hmm. I love it there. Go on holiday and take the dog. But more importantly, I mean, I want to wax lyrical about Cornwall, but it's the community of people that Mark has built, and they're really special, brilliant, talented people down there that they've collected together. And that was just the joy, really, to be part of that process. But we did have, we were on the boat a lot, and with Lee and...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Lee Carter, the fish, whose boat it was that we used, was a fisherman who actually, I sort of studied his accent to get my Cornish accent.
Okay.
So I'd sort of was, you know, had been watching and listening to a lot of Lee before we met him. And then, yeah, everything you see us doing in the film, we did, you know, and we were taken through that.
Yeah, we were taken through that quite rigorously, and you know, the fascinating thing about fishermen, we learn, is that the brutality of the life, you know, they go out and they're sort of the last hunters that exist. They go out and they don't know if they're going to find anything, and they look on their radar and they see, you know, a shape, and they go, oh, let's go there, and then hopefully there's not a boat from France or from further down in Devon or wherever, or Ireland, that they have to compete with, and they go and try and catch these fish, and they don't know if they're going to make money when they come back.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating, that existence and that hardy existence. And and then the pubs that are open, they open at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. fishermen to come home after 3 days to have a drink.
Did you go to the pubs at 3 a.m?
We went pirates.
Well, we left at 3 a.m. I don't think we did it all, actually.
No, I think we played it safe. No, there was a great quote from a fella on this documentary series that Mark got me to watch as reference for the accent. And I remember this fella saying, after he'd been out there for hours potting these lobsters, he's left the pots out there for, so it wasn't the fishing that we were doing, he was potting lobsters. And in 3 days they'd been in the water and he caught one. And he went, well, that's why they call it fishing, not catching. just that attitude is like, we're so used to controlling everything and wanting to be like, you know, but you're so at the mercy of the tides, you know. You only go when the tide lets you. You only catch what's there, and the weather. You're at the mercy of so many of these higher powers, which I think nowadays and in the city, you're so used to being ahead of all of that. You can set an alarm and get beyond the daylight. You can do this, and if you can't get a train, you can get an Uber, you can get whatever it is. Like, and just that attitude of being at peace with, sometimes not being at peace, but just having to accept that there are these bigger forces at play. And that will plays into the theme of, you know, the story as well.
And the integrity and the moral guidelines of the boat. I remember Lee, who was we used his boat, he come in one day and he had a big black eye and cut lip, and said, what happened? And he'd been out with his crew, and he said, argument.
So you need
what happened? Argument. And then, all right, sorted it out in the sea. They just had a fight, bust up,
just men
hit each other a few times, and then that was it. Is it really fascinating guys?
You didn't know each other, you knew of each other very well before, and you didn't know each other before you'd done this. It seems like a very intense way of getting to know each other. I mean, it looks, you know, it looks like a very self-contained, cut-off sort of experience. That boat looked pretty claustrophobic. You were out at sea, you were, you know, gutting fish together. What was that like, just as a bonding experience, and just two guys getting to know each other in such a specific context?
It's pretty easy.
It's great. Right.
Yeah, it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
But, you know, George and I, yes, we bonded very quickly, but there's also a big crew of people that we're part of, and there's Francis and Ed and Mark and then the crew that were there, and just, I think everyone bonded pretty quickly and got together. Well, I mean, the most of them knew each other anyway.
Yeah. We were sort of joking. We were like the new boyfriends at the wedding kind of thing, you know, coming into the family. But
both going out of Mark.
Yeah.
It's a throuple.
But I think, you know, with all of these things, is you jump into these things, but you enter into it with a really open mind as well. You're looking forward to getting on. And, you know, I was so excited to work with Cal and to meet Cal. And so, of course, that speeds and smooths any kind of like, getting to know each other process, because you're both open to it.
Yeah. All right, brilliant. Well, look, it's beautiful to see it on screen. Is there any, your brilliant partnership on screen? It's really something else. It's such a unique film. So thanks for talking. It's really great to meet both of you today.
Nice to meet you too.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Okay, that was Callum Turner and George Mackay talking about Rose of Nevada. We neglected to review it on last week's show because we, and I say we, I meant these two nincompoops, had not seen it. Guys, have you rectified that?
What happened, Chris, is we did a review and then it just disappeared. But then many years later...
It's going
to
come back.
It's going to come back and you'll be able to listen to it then.
Yeah.
Well, we should see what happens because who knows what supernatural shenanigans may take place during the recording of this very podcast.
Wow. I mean, if you're calling us nincompoops, you must have seen it yourself, of course, Chris.
Helen, I refer you to where I was. Uh-huh. I was on the ocean.
Yep.
Surrounded by water.
And then in Manchester. And
surrounded
Hecton
by
Bridge.
Water. Both canals.
Both have canals.
Both have canals.
Or rivers.
And nowhere that was showing Rose of Nevada.
Wow.
And don't look that up.
Okay.
Okay. So, no Rose of Nevada review just yet, but instead we are going to review The Devil Wears Prada 2, because in case you haven't guessed, this is the reviews section of the show. Hell's Bells.
Hello.
Tell us about The Devil Wears Prada 2, which I believe is a sequel to 2006's breakout comedy hit.
I believe in you. You can do this.
The Devil Wears Prada?
Amazing.
Yes.
Wow. Yes.
Ghost Ship.
No.
Okay.
So yes, this has director David Frankel back with the same screenwriter as well, Aileen Brosh McKenna. And this is the sequel, as you said, to the original. So Meryl Streep is once again Miranda Priestly, the high priestess of Runway Magazine. If you think it's a bit like Vogue, you would be 100% right. But these days, I don't know if you're aware of this, guys, magazines have it a little bit harder than they did in 2006. And so her life is a little bit more difficult. In fact, there's been a little bit of a scandal at Runway as we rejoin proceedings. Yes, her right-hand man, who is Nigel, played by Stanley Tucci, has tried to help her through it. But basically, her publishing boss decides he needs to take a hand and he hires back the recently laid off Andy Sachs, a.k.a. Anne Hathaway, who is going to come back to Runway as features editor and try and help Miranda through this difficult time. Miranda, characteristically, is not thrilled about this development because it didn't come from her.
Well, aren't they friends at the end of the last one?
No, they were frenemies is about as close as I would go. So Andy basically has to try and help Miranda through this despite Miranda not really wanting her to.
Right.
Emily, played by Emily Blunt, is also kind of back in the picture. She doesn't work for Runway anymore. She was Miranda's assistant alongside Andy. I'm sure you remember
this. I remember this. I saw The Devil Wears Prada musical just a few months ago.
There you go then. Okay.
Had a great time.
It's a good night out. So she is now head of marketing at Dior when we meet her. So she's like an important advertiser and they need to keep her on board as well, which kind of explains why she's around. They also have Kenneth Branagh as Stuart, wildly overqualified for this role, which is an unusual surname.
Wow.
Yeah, but he's Miranda's new husband.
To Mr. and Mrs. Wildly overqualified for this role, a son, Stuart.
Correct. you also have Simone Ashley as Mary, who is Miranda's new sort of head assistant. Justin Theroux plays a billionaire. Lucy Liu plays his ex-wife. Patrick Bramall.
Of Colin from Accounts.
Colin from Accounts.
Speaking of people overqualified for the roles they're in this film, but go on.
Indeed, is a sort of love interest for Andy that she meets at one point. Some of her friends are back.
This is a very attractive cast.
It's a very good-looking cast, and they wear unbelievable clothes. If anyone would like to send me, say, six of the coats that Miranda wears in Milan, in particular, I would be very
Only
grateful.
Six?
I think I don't
admire
need
your restraint.
All of them. I don't need the leather one. I don't need the one with the feathers. I definitely need the one with both the sequins and the jewels. That was unbelievable.
What about the tassels? Okay.
The tassels are good. I'd take the tassels, but I'm more obsessed with the purple one with the sort of flowers showing on it.
Sure.
Jimbo, what would you take?
I would take anything that Stanley Tucci's character gives out because his full name, I don't know if you know this, is Stanley Kipling, and he does make exceedingly good suits.
Wow. Look, this is a lot of fun. I'm not explaining the plot because it's all twisty and turny and it sounds really boring if you explain it, but it's actually quite a lot of fun to watch. I don't think it's quite as fun as the first film. I don't think the lines are as iconic. I don't think they're going to haunt pop culture in the same way.
We don't know that, though.
We don't know that yet, but I don't get that vibe from them.
Okay.
But at the same time, I had a really nice time watching it. I've now seen it twice. And I just think it's quite fun. And they're these people clearly love each other and are happy to be back working together. And it's kind of interesting just to see how far they've come, you know? So I had a really nice time.
Helen had a really nice time. Jimbo, did you have a really nice time?
I had a quite nice time. I would say, so this is obviously, I mean, people have been saying this is based on Revenge Wears Prada, which I believe is the second book in this particular series. I don't think it has anything in common with that at all. It's a completely new confection. It just felt to me a little bit lightweight in that, you know, I quite like the idea that, you know, it's quite triggering and everything, but they're talking about the demise of print media and how digital is overshadowing everything and everyone's having to make commercial compromises just to hang on to their jobs. You know, all of that felt
quite
real.
Don't know what you mean, mate.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but all of that, again, it doesn't quite feel like the stakes are there. And there are some interesting nods to, and I swear to God, I didn't realize that was Justin Theroux until after the film. It was almost unrecognizable to me. But that particular plot line felt like it was a bit of a nod towards Anna Wintour's relationship, or shall we say, adversity, whatever you want to call it, between Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez. It felt like there was a little bit of commentary in there. Mm. Who knows? Maybe it was a coincidence. It's fun. These characters are fun to be around. It's great that Emily Blunt is back. Miranda Priestly is a fantastic character, and Streep is obviously fantastic at playing her. And I like seeing the evolution of the dynamic. There's a great moment where you see Miranda trying to hang up her own coat because she's so used to throwing it at her assistants and she's kind of struggling. Little callbacks like that are actually quite nice.
Her language is now being policed.
Right, which I thought was quite funny as well. I mean, again, that's a really hoary old trope for this kind of thing, but there was a lightness of touch to that, which I quite liked.
What
it wasn't
the
really
fudge?
Right. But generally speaking, the plot is a little disposable. Some of the beats are a bit familiar. I don't think it really pushes the boat out that much.
Ooh, boats.
And I just felt a little bit that it's a vastly inferior sequel, but it's still a good time. Like, it's fun. Like, and it's been 20 years. Fuck it. Watch it. But I've completely changed my mind. Do it. Watch it now.
Which I believe is the tagline.
It's been 20 years. Fuck it. Watch it.
But what else are you going to do?
If you love The Devil Wears Prada, and many people do, it's a little disappointing.
I actually think the fans are going to love this.
It's going to be huge.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, it's going to be huge.
Things like the musical as well. It's been very much within the zeitgeist for the last 20 years. It's already been building and building and building. Apparently, it's going to be pretty big at the weekend. Not Michael Big. But then again, what can you do, right? But yeah, sounds good. I haven't seen it yet. John, what did you think?
I haven't seen it either.
Okay, thanks, John. John?
Hello!
What? John Nugent is here. We should Anyway, 3 stars? 3 stars for The Devil Wears Prada 2?
3 stars is fair. Yeah.
Okay.
Is that what we gave it?
That is what we gave it.
That is what we gave it.
All right, exciting. Exciting stuff. John Nugent has indeed joined us because supernatural shenanigans do indeed abound. And John's here to review Rose of Nevada because unlike these two nincompoops, you've seen it, John.
Yes. Now we're getting into real cinema.
Yeah, John's done the bare minimum, his job. What have you done this week?
I only watch films if they're hand cranked and shot on 16mm. Thank you very much.
That's actually true.
He hasn't seen Devil Wears Prada.
It's not hand cranked on 16mm. That's how he gets his thrills, this sick fuck.
Was Devil Wears Prada too processed in like old coffee or something? If it wasn't, I'm not interested.
Are there backwards bits in this, John? I'd like a backwards bit.
There's probably some backward bits.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. This is Mark Jenkins' most accessible movie yet. So it's 90% in Czechoslovakian. What's going on with this one?
Yeah. I think there is some debate about whether this is accessible. Neil Alcock, who wrote the review for us for this film, and he thinks Bait, which was his first film, is his most accessible. I mean, it's all on a relative scale. I think all three of his films are relatively inaccessible to the average viewer. Mark Jenkin is a Cornish filmmaker who he's sort of a one-man filmmaking machine. He's an amazing artist. He directs, he writes, he camera operates, he hand cranks the camera himself.
Mm-hmm.
He also writes the score, he produces, he does quite a lot of the producing. You know, he's basically his own genre. And he makes these films in a very, very analog way. He makes them, you know, with barely any like digital effects.
Ennis Main was the second one, wasn't it?
Ennis Main was the second one. And that was incredibly weird. Basically, almost no plot to speak of whatsoever. This definitely has a plot. There is a plot to speak of. It is still quite woozy. It's mysterious. It's unclear what's happening in a lot of it. So the Rose in Nevada, the titular Rose in Nevada, is a fishing vessel in Cornwall. All of Mark Jenkin is from Cornwall, and all of his films are shot on location there. And in this, yeah, this sleepy fishing village in Cornwall where the economy has hit a bit of a downturn. You know, it's a village that, like his first film, you know, has been beset by holiday makers, second homeowners, Airbnbs, that sort of thing. The economy is not what it once was.
Yeah.
And then this old fishing ship, the Rose and Nevada, mysteriously comes into port. And two fishermen, played by Callum Turner and George McKay, take a job to go on a long fishing trip out to sea for a few days. When they come back to the port, the town is mysteriously in the 1990s.
Ooh.
It's like Back to the Future, but Cornish and with fish. Yeah, and so it's a sort of a time travel film, but it's not as like explicitly sci-fi like that. It doesn't really fall into genre tropes. It's more of a vibes movie. It's more atmosphere, and it's, you know, it's dealing with a lot of stuff that Mark Jenkin has been interested in the past. You know, things like the effect of austerity in the modern day capitalism on a small community like the one that he lives in Cornwall. It's also just a really beautiful piece of art, I think. It's, because it is shot on 16mm film. It's processed in a really old school way. It's got this strange, like, post-sync sound, so none of the audio is taken from the film. And the whole film has this sort of very uncanny vibe to it. It feels a little bit off. It's like slightly otherworldly, but you can't quite put your finger on. I thought it was fantastic. I had a great time with it. I think it's really unsettling and weird and gripping and sort of oddly riveting. It will not be for everyone. I think that is fair to say of most of Mark Jenkin's films. But I really think you should make time for it. It's really cool. It's just cool as well to see like movie stars in one of his films. This is the first film where he usually just hires his mates or his wife Mary Woodvine, who's in all of his films, is in this one. But yeah, Callum Turner and George McKay, they're proper movie stars, and they just went to this Cornish village and just did this very analog film. So yeah, I recommend it. 4 stars.
Fantastic. 4 stars then for Rose of Nevada. John, in a weird way, you've also just described Damien McCarthy, I think, who is the Irish filmmaker who makes very, very creepy horror films like Oddity, which was his last movie. And his next movie, which we're just about to discuss, is Hokum. Mm. And for that, he has also recruited a great big shining star in the form of Adam Scott. Star of Severance, of course, and Helen's beloved stepbrothers. It's a fucking Catalina wine mixer.
It's fucking Catalina wine mixer.
What a film. He plays an American writer who goes to an Irish hotel, and there he learns of the legend of a witch who may or may not be trapped in the hotel in a specific room. Hell's bells.
Yeah. So this is Adam Scott as Om Bauman.
Yeah.
That is his actual name.
That's an actual OHM.
OHM.
Yeah.
Yes. Who travels, as you said, to Ireland to spread the ashes of his parents who once visited this hotel in their younger and happier days. And he clearly has some issues. He's kind of playing against type, actually, Adam Scott here, because he's a total dickhead to everyone he meets, pretty much everyone he meets. Apart from like one member of the hotel staff who gets on with, and a man in the woods who offers him essentially mushrooms, just, you know, out of the goodness of his heart. But it does become clear that something is awry in this place. And so it's kind of folk horror tinged, but also kind of hotel horror. I thought it was a really nice mix of, you know, of that kind of shining energy with the energy of something like The Hallow. Right?
Yeah.
Or The Uninvited.
Karn Hardy's film.
Karn Hardy's, which was also, Irish set. Or The Uninvited, similar plots a couple of years ago. This has some of that energy to me, but a much less likable protagonist, which is a really interesting thing, because you're not quite sure at times whether... It introduces a lot more tension, because you really don't know if Adam Scott is going to get out of this and if you want him to, and if he does, if his sanity will be intact, and if you want it to be. You know, it really kind of keeps you guessing that way. I wasn't sure what way this film was going to go at pretty much any moment of its running time, mm-hmm. which I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And it's quite stylish looking, and it does some things that I haven't quite seen done before in this way. I was thoroughly scared by this. I don't think it's one of the all-time great horrors just because you aren't sure if you are rooting for him for quite a lot of the running time. And I think that maybe puts you at a slight remove from him in a way that you aren't with, I don't know, some of the really likable or child protagonists of some of these films, you know. But at the same time, it did succeed in keeping me very much on edge the whole way through.
I like that he's a prick.
I mean, look, it's an interesting myth thing to add to the mix, don't get me wrong, but it just meant I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it if, you know, let's say if he just did.
If a witch showed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, was I rooting for the witch? Maybe. Just saying.
That's assuming there is a witch.
If there is a witch.
May not be a witch.
May not be a witch. But if there was a witch.
If there were a witch. Yeah. A were-witch. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Does she just turn into a witch at the film? I mean, I guess that's possible. Anyway, yeah, I thought it was really successful in scaring me silly. But again, as I always have to say, usual disclaimer applies, mm-hmm. I am a big wimp.
A big old wimp, says Hellspells. John, what did we give this one?
I believe this was 4.
4 stars in for the Werewitch, otherwise known as Hook'em. I agree. I thought it was really, really cracking. A good little horror that scared me, even though I watched it as Damien McCarthy intended on my laptop with my name emblazoned all over the action.
Oh, no.
That fate did not befall me with Greenland 2 Migration. We've been begging for this to show up. Since it opened in the States in January. It is, of course, Jimbo, the sequel to the amazing Rick Roman Waugh, can't believe I say that first time every time, movie with Jerry Butler in which the Earth is bludgeoned to bits by a giant asteroid. I loved Greenland so much. Sort of Donald Trump, he tried to buy it repeatedly.
Oh. Yes, I was going to say, I can't think of any reason why Greenland migration wasn't released before now. It's not like there's been any controversy about that particular place. Who knew?
Who knew? Anyway, so here comes the sequel. I haven't seen it, Jimbo, because quite frankly, A, I haven't had the time. B, I'm scared.
Yeah, with good reason, I would say. Because like Greenland, when it arrived during the pandemic, it was kind of a fun little gem that just sort of dropped out of nowhere. It's a great disaster movie, a comic called Clark, you should always name your comics, coming to destroy the Earth, and the only safe haven was this huge bunker in Greenland. So everyone needs to get to Greenland. And spoiler, they get to Greenland. Now, it's been 6 years since that film. Finally, the sequels have come, and the question is, and I'll answer it now, no. Should they have gone back to this well? Because ultimately, they've been in the bunker now for 5 years. They have recast his son to represent the 5-year time jump.
That's
even
harsh.
Even though 5 years
have passed.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So clearly that 1 year was a deal breaker. But Marina Bakarin and Jerry Butler are back, and environmental fallout from the comet is still ravaging the Earth. The air is kind of toxic. Everything's underwater or not, as the case may be. It's slightly inconsistent. Liverpool's underwater, but the English Channel is bone dry. And the idea is that there are sort of radiation storms, there are earthquakes, there's lots of plate shifting, and the bunker takes a hit. They have to leave the bunker, they have to go out into the world, and they decide that the only way they can possibly survive is to go to the crater, which is basically an area in the south of France, because of course it is, where, for whatever reason, the impact crater has created this sort of, this lush paradise, which is untroubled by the radioactive storm.
I was so... Do you think so?
I was like, is that how it works?
How do they know this?
Because science.
They are talking to people by quite a lot. But and they seem to have some access to maybe like some satellites, which is surprising given the amount of shit that's supposed to be up there in orbit. But okay, fine. I guess, maybe. But I think the answer, honestly, Chris, is none of this makes a lick of fucking sense.
No, it doesn't.
Don't worry about it.
But it doesn't really matter because it's not what I would describe as a particularly plotty film. Because essentially they leave the bunker and then it's just they kind of roughly string together maybe 8 or 9 set pieces, which charts their journey from Greenland to the south of France via Liverpool, which is obviously where they want to go, which is underwater. And some of these are okay. There is a sequence with falling bits of the comet, because basically bits of the comet broken off and they're in orbit and they periodically sort of shower the Earth with fiery balls of rock. That's quite fun. There's a bit involving a channel crossing and a ladder, which is quite tense. But broadly speaking, the action sequences are quite forgettable. And there's not so much in the way of characterization. And the plot is quite plodding. Like, unfortunately, it's what Greenland wasn't. It's just boring. It's just a boring
film. The first
film.
One was really a lovely surprise. Great first hour when they're building up to the revelation that the comet is actually a really serious threat to Earth. And you got the sense that, you know, it was a fairly, quote-unquote, realistic depiction of what the government's response to that.
Up to a point, yeah.
So those chilling moments when he's in the supermarket, and he only gets a message and no one else does, and little things like that, and he has to leave people behind as he goes to the shelter. The second half of the movie is perhaps less successful than the first, but I would still say that the first movie is a very, very solid disaster
but
movie.
But this is just absolutely bog standard. Well, I wasn't going to say shite, but I was going to say bog standard post-apocalyptic twaddle.
Yeah, it's post-apocalypse 101. Like, it's really, really uninspired.
It's like, and as Helen says, brigands.
Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever when you think about, honestly, any of it, especially the crater itself, and not just the geography of it, the fact that, anyway, I'm not gonna spoil this film, should you wish to watch it, but there's a lot in there to get cross about. Okay. And it's a real shame, because Greenland was a lot of fun. I think do a Highlander 2 on this, excise it from the canon, pretend it doesn't exist. They were all aliens, they went back to the planet Zeist, never think about it again.
There can be only one!
Yeah.
Jerry? Okay. Oh.
I genuinely think if you were going to do a sequel to this, you should do a sort of Quiet Place Day 1, like somebody else going through what they went through.
Like, that would be an interesting take on it, yeah. Because that's the most interesting part of this story. Yeah. And it's very dour, the film is as well. Like, it really is. Like, it takes it very seriously.
Yeah.
Oh.
But yeah, it was really disappointing because I've been so excited about seeing this because I really enjoyed Greenland. So I was a bit gutted.
Really? You guys have never mentioned it. You haven't harped on about it for years at all.
Oh, I'm sorry. Colin Farrell is one of nature's true brunettes. This is disappointing.
This was triple the budget of the first film.
It died in its arms at the box office in the States, which I think is why it crept out on Prime Video last week. It was one of those knockdown ginger releases when they go, "Hey everybody, Greenland 2 Migration's on Prime Video," and then they fucking run away.
Yeah,
and then you have to discover it under your own.
But the thing is, and you know, we often say this, I'm not sure I can even recommend this. If you have a Prime subscription and you're just like, I'm bored of an evening, I would honestly save yourself the
James,
hour and a half.
Are you recommending people cancel their Prime subscriptions?
In case you accidentally watch this film. Quick deliveries. But,
did you guys review that Mark Wahlberg, Peter Farrelly movie, Balls Up, which is also on Prime Video and looks like the worst movie ever made?
I genuinely
reviewed that. I gave it one star.
One star?
Yeah.
It was a Balls Up.
I was going to watch it, and then I got another couple of movies that I thought were better. So
holy
we did those
shit. My word.
What did we give exciting. Greenland Migration, John?
We don't currently have a review of that. I mean, it's perhaps unreviewable. I don't know.
I'd say it's probably a 2, not a 1, but I also just don't recommend anyone watch it.
So you're saying, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Rick Roman War.
Okay. Dear.
So 5 stars then for Greenland 2. Migration sounds absolutely tremendous. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by... This is pretty incredible, actually. A double whammy of James's BFF, James Francis Cameron, and the star and subject of his new film, also the co-director of his new film, which is entitled Billie Eilish, Hit Me Hard and Soft. Billie Eilish. That's right. James Cameron and Billie Eilish will be our guests on next week's show. That is pretty fucking spectacular. Very, very excited about that. Jimbo, you didn't do that one.
I didn't do that one.
No.
And I actually quite like Billie Eilish. I'm excited to see this.
But you would have gone, shut up, Billie Eilish, James Cameron.
James Cameron is talking.
At least when he can get a word in.
James Cameron is the one listening to me just monologue at him.
About aliens.
About aliens again.
He's like, Jesus Christ, this guy again. Anyway, that's exciting. It's exciting. Very, very, very excited about that, indeed. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it's goodbye for my now counting 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, John Nugent.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye to James Dyer.
Bye, Chris. Goodbye. I'm going off to cut down a tree. That's it. They messed with the wrong Marine.
You're not it. Never mind.
Shut up, Helen.
It's goodbye from Laura Dern. Goodbye, Laura Dern.
Woman inherits the earth. Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to head back to the ship because you know what? I think I can hear the band breaking into something and Bandyoki is just about to start. We're going to sail away. I've got to be there for, wait a second, that taut iron cable that is up there is just about to, oh no! Ah, let's go ship all over again. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye!